So I wanted to talk about the historical perspective of the Heart Sutra. Just to introduce it slightly, there are two principal aspects, I think, to the Heart Sutra, or at least the Heart Sutra can be analysed in a couple of ways. One aspect is the intellectual side, the side that can be studied. And on the other hand, we have the magical side, the mythical, the poetic, the archetypal, perhaps. So during this course, we aim to look at both of these different sides. And that analysis, that investigation, will be supported by, on the one hand, a more analytical investigation by certain exercises and so on, as we try and look at, as we try and study the material. But on the other hand, there will be chanting and reflecting and investigation of the myth and symbol of the course, and also to an extent exercises. So this will enable us to connect with the more heartfelt side, the more poetic side of the Heart Sutra. Both of these, of course, are vitally important and should not be excluded. But not only that, they each support the other. So we'll try and work on those two different levels. So let's get started at the beginning then, really. And Buddhism begins, of course, with the original teaching, the original Dharma, from the time of the historical Buddha, 2,600 years ago. Or at least it does in the conventional sense. It could also be true, probably is also true, to say that, in a sense, Buddhism is universal and hence is beyond time, describing as it does, or at least giving us the tools to describe the nature of existence. It is, in a sense, beyond time. It is perpetual. But nevertheless, let's begin at the beginning with the teaching at the time of the Buddha. And of course, the Buddha began his ministry, you might say. He began to attract followers. And over his lifetime, his following spread, so he had hundreds, perhaps thousands of different followers across northern India, some of which were wanderers such as himself. Other people were people living in regular lives with regular jobs, householders as they were called. And then at the time of the Buddha's death, his teaching carried on. His original Dharma was formalized in an oral tradition. It was not written down to several hundreds of years later, but it was formalized, standardized, and his teaching carried on for many hundreds of years. Now, one of the things that the Buddha regarded as a really bad thing to do, one of the most terrible things to do, was to cause a schism in the spiritual community, in the Sangha. But despite this warning and this concern, nevertheless, schism did take place in the Buddhist Sangha. Perhaps it's inevitable. I don't know. But all religions seem to have these sorts of schisms, much as the way we have in Christianity, with where we have Protestantism and Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox and various other smaller schools. And as you have with Islam, with Sunni and Shiite. So there seems to be these schisms take place. And it is the case, perhaps sadly, that it's happened in Buddhism too. And maybe it takes place because of differences of opinion or disagreement, perhaps even argument. But nevertheless, even quite shortly after the death of the Buddha, schism took place. And so you started to have separate schools. Now, of these schools that pertain almost to the time of the Buddha and base themselves entirely on the spoken word of the Buddha, on his original teachings only and nothing else, or at least only commentaries on his original teachings, of those original schools, only one remains, the Theravada school. It's also referred to sometimes as Hinayana, but that's a slightly derogatory term, as we'll come to in a moment. So we'll stick with the Theravada. And we can see that now in Sri Lanka and some other countries. It's maintained itself for those thousands of years, going back to the time of the Buddha, and having maintained and kept for posterity, for us now, the original teachings of the Buddha all that time. However, there was a major breaking away about 500 years after the death of the Buddha, a major transformation, a major new area emerging from Buddhism about 500 years after the death of the Buddha. It's sometimes called the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma. So major was it, so significant was it. And that's become referred to as the Mahayana, the greater vehicle. And hence the term Hinayana, or lesser vehicle, is a slightly derogatory term used by the Mahayanists. After about 500 years, Buddhism had become very established. It was the religion of the monarchy and the ruling classes, as well as the ordinary people, across huge swathes of northern India. Rather than having simple wandering people wandering about, collecting food from householders and living a very simple lifestyle, as took place at the time of the Buddha, there were established monasteries and universities, which to some extent were good things. Nalanda, the great university of Buddhism, had at its height 10,000 students and 2,000 teachers. So it's quite a big place. But it did change the character, perhaps, of Buddhism. It wasn't quite the same as it was at the time of the Buddha. It had become established. More than that, though, perhaps it had become somewhat analytical. Rather than being heartfelt, it had been more study-based. So those two aspects that we mentioned right at the start of this talk, the intellectual side, the study side, as in contrast with the magical, mythical, poetic, maybe the first had tended to gain the upper hand. And it's speculated that the Mahayana arose in response to that, to redress the balance, as it is much more heartfelt. It also is characterised by much greater imagery. So all these myriads of different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they pertain to the Mahayana school. The Theravadan and the other schools of the original teaching did not employ these images of these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You may see images of the Buddha himself and possibly of Maitreya, the Buddha to come. But there are no other images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the Theravada tradition. So with the Mahayana, you had this great flowering of this pantheon of Buddhist images, and a great and a much more heartfelt response to Buddhism. You also had the emerging of the Bodhisattva ideal. So whereas with the original teaching of Buddhism, it was the idea that one would attain enlightenment so that one can liberate oneself, the Bodhisattva ideal was, in contrast, to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings, and in fact to put off one's own final enlightenment until all other living beings had been saved from suffering. So one could say that Mahayana was a criticism of Buddhist orthodoxy of its day. The Mahayanists would perhaps say that rather than being true to the tradition of Buddhism, the Buddhist orthodoxy of the day had become somewhat decadent and become very reliant on establishment such as things like universities and monasteries had become very analytical and a bit dry, perhaps. So they were trying to reinvigorate Buddhism. On the other hand, the Theravadas and the other schools of the time would perhaps argue that they were the custodians of the traditional teaching of the Buddha, And that anything beyond that, these new developments were just that. They weren't really authentic. They were aberrations, perhaps. So you have these differing opinions. It raises a question whether, well, which of these opinions perhaps is correct, or whether they both have elements of truth in them. But also, if one does accept that the Mahayana was a valid response, is this always necessary in religion? Is reinvention always needed? Does decadence always set in to any religious system after a period of time? Does it always need to be shaken up? Again, we've seen in Europe, in Christian Europe, the Reformation taking place, a radical change in Christianity, and a counter-reformation in response to that. In any case, the Heart Sutra itself arose from the Prajnaparamita texts, which are of the Mahayana tradition. The Mahayana tradition in turn led to Vajrayana, or Tantric Buddhism. Although the difference between Mahayana and Vajrayana is much less distinct than between Mahayana and Theravada. Vajrayana is characterized by wrathful deities and the like. So you see imagery where you have perhaps quite violent images, wrathful deities carrying various weapons, drinking blood from skull caps and so on. The idea being that even our most passionate emotions, sexuality perhaps, or our anger, our frustration, these, rather than being set aside or overcome, in fact could be transmuted and employed as further fuel on the road to enlightenment. And then hence Tantric Buddhism is seen to be the most rapid way to gain enlightenment. Also from Mahayana, or at least a form of Mahayana, is the Chan and Zen traditions of China and Japan, Korea and so on. Now, as the Heart Sutra arose within the Mahayana, it is a teaching that's accepted by all the schools that arise from Mahayana and afterwards, including Chan and Zen schools. But it is not accepted as a teaching by the Theravada, because it does not date back to the time of the Buddha itself. Its true name, in fact, is the Prajnaparamita Hridaya, which means the heart of the perfection of wisdom, or perhaps more accurately, the essence of the perfection of wisdom. It's perhaps a condensation of all the perfection of wisdom texts. Historically, it was written in the year something like 300 CE to 500 CE, that's to say in the common era, initially written in Chinese and then later translated into Sanskrit, which was the language of Buddhism of the time. Mythically, though, it is set at the time of the Buddha, in fact in the presence of the Buddha, although that's unlikely to be an historic truth. It takes place at the Vulture's Peak, which is a place in northern India that the Buddha frequently visited and gave sermons and meditated. And in fact, you can still go there today if you wish and visit it. It's on the pilgrimage trail. So the talk took place in the presence of the Buddha. And apart from the first four lines, it consists of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara talking to Shariputra, one of the Buddha's disciples. Now this is significant in a number of ways. It could be said to represent historical truth, as portrayed by Shariputra, who was an historical individual who lived at the time of the Buddha and was one of the Buddha's primary disciples. It represents his historical truth versus archetypal truth, which of course is represented by Avalokiteshvara, a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva of compassion, and an archetypal figure. It expresses, perhaps, the Mahayana attempt to redress the balance to a more heartfelt, a more feeling, a more emotional side. Avalokiteshvara, of course, represents the Mahayana, whereas Shariputra represents the Buddhist orthodoxy of the day. But they could also be said to represent elements of ourselves. Shariputra representing our intellectual side, whereas Avalokiteshvara represents our spiritual insight. So within this Heart Sutra text, the Pranipāramitā Hṛdaya, we have a whole range of layers of different meanings going on, many of which we'll be exploring in the coming few weeks.